Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, 6 months into the Israel-Hamas war, is Biden's approach to it shifting? During a call last week with Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu, Biden called the humanitarian crisis in Gaza unacceptable and said an immediate ceasefire was essential to protect innocent civilians. But the White House has also not slowed military aid to Israel, approving a weapons transfer on the day that Israeli forces killed humanitarian aid workers. As Biden faces mounting pressure from progressive and some centrist Democrats to put conditions on aid, and from crucial swing state voters who say they'll withhold support in November, we take a closer look at how the administration's Israel policy could be changing. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Active fighting has slowed in southern Gaza after the Israeli military withdrew from the area over the weekend to, quote, recuperate and prepare for future operations, according to officials. As Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu faces pressure from far-right members of his coalition to attack Rafah and root out Hamas, he also faces intense pressure from President Biden not to advance on Rafah, where 1.5 million Palestinians have sought refuge. 6 months into the Israel-Hamas war that has killed 33,000 in Gaza, left much of it in rubble, and on the verge of famine, Israel has been unable to secure the release of about half the 240 hostages kidnapped on October 7th, when Hamas invaded Israel and killed 1,200 people. And analysts say Biden's ability to hold to his firm commitment of support for Israel while Gaza's civilians starve may be nearing a breaking point. We take a closer look at whether recent signs that Biden is willing to take a harder line with Israel will result in action. And to help us do that, I am joined by a panel of White House reporters. Yasmeen Abutaleb is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to Forum, Yasmeen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also, Erica L. Green is with us, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Erica, so glad to have you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Alex Ward, White House reporter covering national security for Politico, is with us, also author of the book The Internationalists, The Fight to Restore American Foreign Policy After Trump. Alex, really glad to have you as well.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
So one of the signs that President Biden may be willing to condition support for Israel came in a phone call with Prime Minister Netanyahu last Thursday. Yasmeen, can you remind us what happened on that call and why it has been viewed as so significant?
Yeah, so President Biden held this call with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu after an Israeli strike killed seven aid workers from World Central Kitchen, the aid group run by Jose Andres. And according to a White House summary of the call, the president said the situation in Gaza was unacceptable. And most notably, the thing that really signified at least a willingness to change the U.S. policy towards Israel was that in the summary of the call, the White House said that President Biden told Netanyahu that if Israel did not take a series of immediate concrete steps to address the humanitarian situation in Gaza, that the White House would reassess its relationship with Israel and would reassess its policy with Israel as it relates to Gaza. So this was left very vague. That could mean any number of things, but the way most of us read it was that it was at least a willingness to threaten conditioning aid and military aid to Israel. Again, the White House has not said how it will assess whether Israel has complied with the steps that Biden said they need to take and what reassessing the relationship would look like. But it was the first time in the six-month conflict the president has even indicated a willingness to publicly threaten that sort of move.
Yeah. Alex, is that what stood out to you? And is that how you also read the message that Biden was conveying?
Yeah, there's no question. That was the harshest the administration has been with Israel to date. Of course, it came in a, you know, paper statement versus in actual words from President Biden. The other thing that I've heard from officials is that it could be military aid conditions. It could also be sanctions on far right members of Netanyahu's government, or perhaps even more sanctions at the West Bank. I mean, there's a plethora of options here, but no question that now that Israel's actions are being watched more than ever before. And let's recall National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby went to the White House podium just moments after the Biden Netanyahu call and said that the, you know, timeline for this observation would be hours and days. In that hours period, we saw the opening of the Erez crossing, the Ashdod port, and also more trucks getting into Jordan. We're now in the days portion, and as Yasmin rightly notes, we don't actually know what the administration is looking for within this day's portion. And we don't know how long days is. I mean, we're maybe almost, closing in on a week since the call. So a lot of ambiguity and a lot of unknowns.
Yeah. I was also struck by the fact that you noted that top U.S. official warnings were, I think you called it a screaming neon sign for Israel with respect to American politics. And I'm wondering what you mean by that.
I mean, look, Israel has enjoyed, for rightful and other reasons, bipartisan support from from the Washington D.C. Lately, you're seeing Israel lose a lot of support from Democrats and even some Republicans. Only a few, but some question America's continued policy towards Israel. I mean, to see not only Biden issue that statement, but Senator Majority Leader Chuck Schumer call for elections that effectively would, if the polls are accurate, lead to Netanyahu's ouster. To see Gregory Meeks, the ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, represents New York just this morning, consider blocking selling warplanes to Israel, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is a very different political environment for Israel to operate in, and one that is not as clear cut for them. And if you're Benjamin Netanyahu, you're thinking, do I have to change my ways, or maybe I just double down and eventually Democrats will come home to backing Israel? But that is more of a question than it has been in recent history.
Erica Green, you describe Biden's approach with Netanyahu as a sharp turn. What did you mean by that? And why do you think this particular killing of the World Central Kitchen workers affected Biden so much, as a lot of people have reported?
Sure. I mean, as my colleagues have said, it did represent a sharp turn in that, the president had been clear that he was unwavering in his support for Israel's, right to defend itself against Hamas, and unwavering of his support of this war. And this was the first time we've seen him waver, right? And I would also say that, this was the, he had, after his State of the Union address, he was caught on a hot mic discussing the come to Jesus moment and come to Jesus conversation that he was going to have with the prime minister. And that is apparently what we've seen. As Alex noted, to even be having a conversation about whether the United States would abandon, decades of U.S. foreign policy when it comes to Israel is really notable, and it was sharp, because we have to remember, just months ago, the White House was condemning its Democrats in Congress, members of their own party, for even suggesting a ceasefire, for even suggesting a change in policy, and now here we are, where we see the White House and the president echoing a lot of those calls. So that's why I would characterize it as that. In terms of why this particular tragedy was the one that broke through, there are questions about that. I mean, it's fairly obvious. There have been more humanitarian aid workers killed in this conflict per the White House than any other in recent history. Yes. NSC spokesperson John Kirby said that the president was particularly shaken by this. We know that he and Jose Andres have a personal relationship, and in an interview this weekend, the chef said that he had very strong words for the president about how he views how Israel is waging this war, which he called a war against humanity itself. And he said that he spoke on behalf, you know, not just for the seven workers who were killed, but for the thousands that have been affected and what he's seen on the ground. But, you know, there are questions about, you know, why this one and not, you know, say the civilians and people who were desperately running toward an aid convoy last month and were gunned down as they tried to get food. And folks have raised that. That's not a question that I've heard the White House answer, but the humanitarian, you know, I think the culmination of the humanitarian crisis, which the White House has deemed now a catastrophe, there's been some escalation even in rhetoric, has brought this all to roost.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. Curious what you think about Biden's shift in rhetoric, and do you think his policy toward Israel, his approach toward Israel, is in fact really shifting beyond the things that he is saying? You can tell us by emailing forum@kqed.org, finding us on our social channels at KQED Forum. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. We're joined by Erica Green of the New York Times, Yasmin Abutaleb of the Washington Post, and Alex Ward of Politico. And Yasmin, I want to ask you, and actually want to ask all three of you, really, how you assess the amount of leverage the U.S. has over Israel, how you would characterize it.
Well, I think the U.S. has an enormous amount of leverage over Israel. It's just been unwilling to use that leverage. And I think this has been a point of frustration for many Democrats in the House and Senate, that the White House, there have been lots of reports about Biden being frustrated with Netanyahu, the White House being frustrated with the way Israel is carrying out its military campaign, and sort of throwing their hands up and saying, well, what can we do about it? They're an independent country. That is true. The U.S. can't force Israel to do anything, but the U.S. is Israel's biggest backer. There have been more than 100 weapons transfers to Israel. My colleague John Hudson has done some great reporting on this, that the administration has sent weapons to Israel where they fall just below the threshold that's required to notify Congress. So there has been a desire to avoid the debate in Congress, excuse me, especially as criticism has grown, and to make sure these weapons are getting to Israel as quickly as possible. And I think there's no question that Israel's ability to carry out this war, because attention is in Gaza, but they are fighting on multiple fronts. They're fighting on the northern border with Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon. There is, of course, now this bigger threat from Iran. You know, Israel, this didn't get as much attention with everything else going on, but wants to strike in Damascus, Syria, and killed an Iranian general along with several others. So that threat has risen significantly. So there's no question that Israel's ability to carry out this war and to fight on all those fronts would be severely hampered without all of the military support the U.S. has given it. And even beyond that, Israel's become much more isolated over the last 6 months because of the way they've been conducting this war in Gaza. More than 33,000 Palestinians have been killed in the course of this war. Erica and Alex both discussed this, but you know, there's just absolutely catastrophic humanitarian situation on the ground with a famine underway. And so the U.S. and Biden specifically has sacrificed a lot to keep backing Israel, not only with military arms, but diplomatically as well at the United Nations and elsewhere. So without the U.S., Israel would really be left standing alone. Mm. So there is an enormous amount of leverage the U.S. could exert. They have just been unwilling to take that step.
We're talking about the Biden administration's Israel policy and how it may be evolving. More with us after the break. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. 6 months into the Israel-Hamas war, we're looking at changing rhetoric from Biden, Biden's willingness to take a harder line with Israel, and what actions that might result in, with Yasmin Abutaleb, White House reporter for The Washington Post, Alex Ward, a White House reporter covering national security for Politico, Erica Green, White House correspondent for The New York Times, and with you, our listeners. What questions do you have about Biden's Israel policy? And do you think it is, in fact, changing, shifting beyond his rhetoric? How do you think Biden has handled the war so far? Do you think he's managed a difficult line well, or that it's been a disaster, or something in between? What actions would you like to see Biden take with respect to the war? You can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels, on X, Instagram, on our digital community, on Discord. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And a listener on Instagram comments, the more Biden falls behind in the polls, the more crocodile tears there are for Palestinians. So that's one perspective here. And I do want to talk about the pressures that Biden is facing here at home. But Alex, I do want to ask you, so Yasmin was saying enormous leverage over Israel, just been unwilling to use it. Is that how you would characterize the U.S.'s leverage over Israel?
Absolutely. I mean, look, we sort of have a test case already, right? I mean, after that call between Biden and Netanyahu, where Biden said, look, you got to do these things within hours or else, those things were done within hours, right? That was Erez, that was Ashdod, that was the trucks. So we already have a test case here, even though the Israelis would say a lot of those things were in the works. Fine, that may be true, but they didn't happen until after Biden effectively threatened Israel with some sort of reprimand. So it's clear that there are ways that the U.S. has leverage here, and we've seen that throughout history, including in Republican administration. So it's not really a question as to whether that is leverage, which leads me to Yasmin being correct that just the U.S. hasn't really used it. Now, you talk to Biden and other officials, they'll tell you why. One is you need to defend Israel as it is another nation that is, you know, fighting an entity that wants to wipe it off the face of the earth. That, of course, we saw the deadliest day for a single day for Jews as the Holocaust when 1,200 people died, were killed on October 7th, and that they are fighting an enemy, as Kirby, the national security spokesperson, said, a genocidal enemy that is, you know, looking to continue to attack Israel again and again and again, and they have embedded themselves within the civilian population, human shields. They, of course, still have hostages. There's a hostage deal to negotiate. Israel deserves America's support. That said, the criticism, including coming from Democrats, is doesn't need to be blank check support, that there are ways to encourage Israel to fight Hamas in Gaza in a very complicated, brutal urban environment in other ways, in part because it is a democracy and needs to hold itself to a higher standard.
So, Erica, there is a lot of pressure on Biden to use that leverage to end the war here from voters and communities at home. And you reported on the White House Ramadan gathering last week, and I think you called it a moment that epitomized just how problematic the war in Gaza has become for President Biden. So talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, there are crucial constituencies who have had enough, who they don't see a way back to Biden, given how this war has played out, given how he has managed it from the very beginning. From, you know, we've seen this rhetorical evolution, you know, from questioning the death toll, which still so many people, I mean, that is still very prescient for so many folks, you know, from questioning the death toll to then, you know, elevating that death toll in his State of the Union address. They cannot circle this square. They hear him say, you know, that they support that the U.S. will support Israel to the end, but then on the other hand, call for humanitarian aid. And I think, you know, one of my colleagues at the Times, Peter Baker, wrote it so perfectly in a story a couple weeks ago, where he said, you know, from the skies of Gaza, you know, death and life fall from the sky at the same time. And so that is why it was so difficult for so many people to accept an invitation from the White House to go and celebrate a holy month. They could not get people to attend. The folks who did attend were clear that they could not possibly sit and have a dinner with administration officials, including the president, while tens of thousands of children and women and people starve in Gaza. And, you know, during that meeting, they had doctors attend who had treated patients in Gaza, who gave firsthand accounts of what they saw on the ground. And those are some of the first times that the president had heard from people directly involved in the conditions on the ground in that capacity. And from what we understand, that really did have an impact on him too. But, you know, it's one of those doctors had to get up and leave. 5-6 minutes into the meeting, he went, he accepted the invitation. A lot of the folks who attended faced immense pressure not to. He felt obligated to go and share what he saw. And he also felt obligated to leave once he had communicated that. So, you know, it was, it really was emblematic of where a lot of folks who oppose this war, not just in the Arab Muslim Palestinian community, but where they are. They just see mixed messages. We hear leverage on one hand, but it's not necessarily yielding much, you know, in results in terms of changing the conditions on the ground in Gaza, and they've just kind of given up at this point.
Yasmeen, I'm struck by Erica saying that Arab and Muslim community voters will have a hard time coming back to Biden, coming back by November, I imagine, is what's on his mind, of course. And you covered the effort by Michigan's Arab and Muslim community to vote uncommitted in their primary. Do you feel like anything has changed in terms of the feelings in the community since then?
I don't. I think Erica is exactly right, especially on the Biden questioning the Palestinian death toll back at the end of October being really a sticking point in the community. I mean, people are still really angry about that. It comes up in every conversation. And the other thing that also comes up all the time is the 100-day statement that Biden put out marking 100 days of the war. This was the statement in January where Biden marked 100 days in captivity for the hostages who were taken on October 7th. And there was no mention of the Palestinian death toll in that statement, which had surpassed 20,000 at that point. And so that's still a point of deep anger. And what a lot of Arabs and Muslims describe as dehumanization by the president, that in their view, he has not valued Palestinian lives, Palestinian humanity, and anywhere near the same capacity as he has Israeli lives, and has not talked about the suffering in Gaza in anywhere near the same way as he has the suffering in Israel on October 7th. So I think, you know, the uncommitted movement in Michigan, but elsewhere was pretty successful by the goals that the organizers had laid out in Michigan. They were able to get more than 100,000 votes, which is, you know, there's differing views on that. If you talk to the Biden campaign and Biden allies, they'll say the percentage, which was around 13% of people who voted uncommitted, was not starkly different than the percentage who voted uncommitted for Obama in 2012. But, you know, Biden's margin of victory in Michigan in 2020 was about 150,000 votes. And Michigan has a sizable Arab and Muslim community. I think it's more than 200,000 registered voters. So that's, if you don't get those votes, you have to make them up elsewhere. I think the Biden campaign feels like a number of people will still ultimately vote for him in November because of the threat of a Trump presidency. But in my experience and a couple different trips to Michigan at this point, I think there are some people who would still like to support Biden, but have not seen what they need to see in terms of the major change in policy. But I think a sizable number are, just as Erica said, they are not coming back to him, and they will not find their way back to him.
And let me read some more listener comments. Alexis writes, why did Biden care more about the 7 aid workers who were killed than the 30,000 Palestinians who've been killed? It's because they're not Palestinian. They're foreigners, white, and thus deemed human. The dehumanization of Palestinians has been appalling. Jonathan writes, the 9/11 attacks killed 3,000 U.S. citizens, and in response, we sent 150,000 soldiers to Afghanistan and left them there for 20 years. Yet when Israel seeks to defend itself, the world demands a ceasefire. Blatant double standard. There was a ceasefire. Hamas broke it. Let me go to William in Belvedere. William, you're on.
Yes, thank you very much. I would like to change my question a little bit, because one of your most recent speakers said something that really prompted a thought on my part. And it has to do with the election effect for Biden and Trump. I wonder whether, and perhaps she could give a perspective on this, whether there might be people, say in Michigan, who would say, look, how much worse could Trump be? 32,000 dead people. How much worse could Trump be? Hmm. And might feel that by defeating Biden, that they would send a message about their power, their economic power, their political power, to affect elections.
Well, William, let me put that question to Yasmin.
I think William summed it up exactly right. And that is exactly the discussion that's taking place in the Arab and Muslim community in Michigan, that, you know, to be clear, people are not voting for Trump. They don't want a Trump presidency. But to your point, you know, how much worse could the situation in Gaza be given the enormous death toll, the humanitarian situation, but even more than that, that this would be sending a message to not only Biden, but future Democratic candidates, that this community does have voter power and does have the ability to swing elections. And so candidates need to court their vote, just like they need to court votes from other influential communities. And so one point that you've seen some of these activists make is, you know, there have been a number of people who, of course, disagree with this tactic. About 80% of this community voted for Biden in 2020 and have said, you know, we understand your anger, but we can't risk a Trump presidency. Biden is a lesser of two evils. And if we get Trump, that's going to be worse for the Muslim community. And I think their response to that now is Biden needs to win their votes. And if he does not do what he needs to do to earn their votes, then it's not their fault if Trump wins. There are obviously a number of people who disagree with that view, but that is the argument that they make.
Well, Alex, let's take a closer look at what Trump has said. There was reporting about his interview with conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt, where he essentially said that Israel should, quote, get it over with, and that they're absolutely losing the PR war. How do you interpret that in terms of what his approach to Israel would be?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mystery. I mean, Trump spent 4 years of his presidency basically allowing Israel to do what it wanted. In this case, you know, is it, you know, they should finish the job before global condemnation comes in even harder, in which case, you know, go into Rafah now and take out Hamas? Or is it end the war at this moment, make some sort of deal, get a ceasefire going? Listening to Trump's rhetoric, I think he's more on the ceasefire camp, but it is still a bit ambiguous. But there, people have been very confused by his statements, and including those who used to work with him on the Middle East portfolio, saying, you know, Trump, again, used to be as pro-Israel as it gets, especially with Netanyahu in power. So, you know, what are these statements that he's saying? Is it a political calculation? We do know that Trump likes to move with the wind a bit. He might be seeing, you know, a lot of public reaction coming against Israel now and wants to be able to say that he can, that he's, you know, talked on both sides. But it is wholly unclear.
Well, let me go next to caller Noah in Oakland. Noah, you're on. Hi, Noah, are you there? And we'll see if we can reconnect with Noah. In the meantime, I do want to just get a better understanding of this call for conditioning future military aid, weapons transfers, and so on how Israel continues to handle the situation, the humanitarian crisis, so on. And well, first, I'd like to know how effective you think that letter that more than 30 House Democrats signed, including Nancy Pelosi, Alex, will be in swaying Biden, or even, you know, the kinds of things that Chris Coons is saying, a longtime strong ally of President Biden, that he, for the first time, can see an argument for conditioning aid.
It's going to have some effect, no question, right? I mean, Biden is a guy who cares about his inner circle. He cares about people who've won elections. He cares about more centrist foreign policy thinkers, let's say. And the fact that this is coming from inside the House, in terms of, you know, Biden's worldview, that's going to have some sway with him. I would say, you know, one Chris Coons is worth 1,000, bureaucratic defections. And I think we should note that the pressure hasn't been, although we have seen some, you know, media cover, folks at the State Department and others leave, it's really only been about 3 high profile, defections like that. So if you're Biden, you're not really caring about that too much. There will always be disaffected progressives and pro-Palestinian voices inside the government. It does matter way more than a Chris Coons or a Pelosi or even a Richard Haass, the former president of the Council on Foreign Relations, has come out, you know, and he was served in Republican administrations, coming out and saying that it was time to make some sort of put forward some sort of reprimand for Israel, that Biden was looking weak for, you know, talking tough but doing nothing. Now, did that lead to his actions on the call? Perhaps, but as I think we've all sort of danced around or noting, you know, they haven't really done anything yet. I mean, a threat to do something is still a threat to do something. It is not doing something. Right. So has Biden's, you know, rhetoric turned sharply? Sure, but have his actions? Not wholly, in my view.
Yeah. Are you hearing of any internal debates or disagreements within the administration in the inner circle, you know, that level for Biden, who have his ear, Alex?
I mean, some, right? I mean, the administration's not a monolith. There were some high-level folks who were saying earlier, maybe, you know, Israel should be pressured. There were others saying, stay the course. We should note that the administration's firm line on this has been, it's better to hug Israel and push them in private than to break with them publicly. And they will say that strategy has been successful, in part because Israel didn't go fully all out in Gaza and has restrained itself from an all-out invasion of Rafah at this point. I'm sure, you know, when you see the widespread bombing campaign and the level of humanitarian devastation, that maybe doesn't ring as strong. But if you talk to the administration, they feel, look, it's bad. It could have been worse. Hard to imagine that's sort of a winning message. But all this to say is that there are folks in the administration that would have liked to see a change sooner. But I think now everyone's mostly on the same page with where they are.
Yes, I mean, if Biden agreed to do something around weapons transfers, how would that even work? I understand you reported on how the State Department last week received written assurances from Israel that it's U.S.-supplied weapons, we're not violating international or U.S. laws. So what is the State Department mulling right now?
So they actually already made this assessment. So in February, the White House put out what they call the National Security Memorandum, and this was in response to a push in Congress, specifically among a large portion of Senate Democrats, to condition aid to Israel in the aid bill that was being debated that would tie Ukraine and Israel aid together. There was a desire to avoid a divisive vote on the floor by Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, and by the White House. So they did this national security memorandum that what it basically does is puts all in one place a number of laws that are on the books about countries receiving U.S. military assistance. And so the two main points of this memorandum were that countries receiving this assistance need to provide written assurances that they are not violating international humanitarian law with using these weapons. And the second one is that they're not obstructing or impeding the delivery of U.S.-assisted or U.S.-supported humanitarian aid. So at the end of March, the U.S. had to decide whether to basically say Israel was telling the truth about, especially on the humanitarian aid front. There were a number of Democrats who said, you know, you should not validate these claims, but the State Department decided to.
Oh, so they said that Israel was. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour about the Biden administration's Israel policy and how it might be changing, whether recent signs that Biden has been willing to take a harder line or a harsher tone with Israel might result in action. We're talking about it with Erica L. Green, White House correspondent for The New York Times, Alex Ward, White House reporter covering national security for Politico, and Yasmin Abu Talib, White House reporter for The Washington Post. And we're talking about it with you, our listeners, what you think about Biden's Israel policy. Do you think that you are seeing a shift in his approach to Israel beyond rhetoric? And how do you think Biden has handled the war so far? Disastrously, or he's managed a difficult line pretty strategically? What actions would you like to see Biden take with respect to the war in Gaza? And what effect do you think Israel's policy will have on the November election? Will it affect your vote? MK writes, this is the first time I've had hope that Biden is turning a corner on support for Israel and actually supporting Palestinians in Gaza. Another listener writes, as awful as the war in Gaza is, voters won't jeopardize American democracy by putting Trump back into office. And let's see if we got Noah back. Noah in Oakland, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. My question, comments, focuses on part of the discussion where we're talking about kind of what comes to my mind, is what actually changed here. Mm-hmm. Because people who have been paying attention to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for the last several decades know that Israel killing aid workers is not a new thing. Israel killing journalists and unarmed Palestinian civilians is not a new thing. They haven't done 32,000 in the number of months like they are now, but they've killed huge numbers of Palestinian civilians throughout the occupation who cannot even begin to be characterized as terrorists or Hamas. And we see it now. Israel claimed that 12 aid workers working for UNRWA were part of Hamas. Turns out they didn't have evidence for pretty much any of them, weren't able to produce it at all. And so the question on my mind again is, what actually changed here? And what seems to me to be the case is that this uncommitted vote has finally politically scared Democrats. I don't think there is an ounce of care in the heart of Biden, in the heart of Nancy Pelosi, in the heart of anyone else in the Democratic Party who really thinks that this was a turning point.
Well, no,
all that means is that you weren't paying attention.
I appreciate you sharing your view. And that really is the question here, is whether or not the things that he is saying might turn into action that might help people feel differently than Noah feels. David writes, the U.S. needs to make it clear that they support the state of Israel while reemphasizing that the current government is unacceptable in terms of its commitment to human life. So Erica Green, Netanyahu confirmed again, that Israel is planning a full-scale attack on Rafah. If you can share a little bit about what he is saying, and if you see any scenario where Biden can exert enough pressure to force Israel to abandon those plans, because he's strongly come out against it.
Yeah, I mean, so look, the administration, the president, the administration has reiterated over time and again that a full-scale assault on Rafah would be catastrophic and cannot happen. What we have not seen, as is the case in a lot of the turning points in this particular conflict, is whether or not Israel will change course. And so far, we have no real strong indication that they will. You know, the prime minister has been clear that he still intends to conduct a military operation in Rafah. And so they seem to be, and my colleagues can chime in, but there seems to be an impasse because we know that there are nearly 2 million people in that region. And it's, you know, the United States is clear that should there be a full-scale military assault, those people will not survive. So this is another instance where we have these two leaders having a phone call, coming out saying diverging, you know, having diverging views on what happens next. And all eyes are on Rafah. It's going to be, look, Israel is defending itself, as are its allies like Germany, who's supplying weapons in the International Court of Justice against genocide claims. The experts, everyone that I've been talking to, say that this will be a defining moment in that case, depending on how Israel conducts this operation, and depending on whether or not the United States aids in it. So that's where we are right now. And we're, you know, anxiously watching for any developments on that.
Erica, has any progress been made in the new round of ceasefire talks in Cairo?
I am not aware. Based on our reporting today, there has not been any significant movement on the ceasefire talks. But I can tell you that this changes rapidly hour to hour. So who knows what that will look like by the end of today.
Alex, do you see this coming to a real clash between Benjamin Netanyahu and Biden? There have been some suggestions that Biden's tough talk, his suggestion that he's conditioning aid, might have given him some leverage with the far right parts of his coalition and an ability for him to approve more humanitarian aid getting into Gaza. But there are others who have said, this is not good because the two men have such different objectives when it comes to this war. And it
when it comes to what they need politically, right? Bibi wants to extend the war. Biden wants it to end.
Yeah, I mean, look, Netanyahu's in between a hard place, right? I mean, on the one hand, he's got Biden telling him to wind down the war, accept a ceasefire, do a hostage deal, minimize humanitarian casualties. On the other hand, you've got members of his far-right government, including Itamar Ben-Gvir, the national security minister, calling on him basically to invade Rafah now, to not care too much about the Palestinian issue. And we've seen the Israeli government also, you know, claim more land of the West Bank during this conflict, which got scant attention. So he kind of can't move. And also on the one hand, yes, Netanyahu can go, Biden's asking me to do this, but his own government doesn't want him to feel like he acts because of pressure from the U.S. So he can't really win here, which is why you've had tons of people in Israel and elsewhere say Netanyahu needs to go. And you've obviously seen Schumer say that for the simple reason that the politics, his own personal politics, his own legal issues, and just his politics in Israel just don't work for what the severity and the scale of what's happening. It feels like nothing will really work. And let's recall, as I mentioned earlier, the hug in public, push in private strategy. You know, they tried this in 2021. There was a smaller war between Hamas and Israel. And this is the strategy they use. And it worked to a certain extent because that fight ended after 11 days. But of course, the context was very different then, right? There was no October 7th attack. The Israeli public was still going against Netanyahu. There wasn't so much anger. There wasn't the far-right government that he has. Now he's got the legal issues, the far-right government, and an Israeli public that we should always note is still for defeating Hamas, right? They're not behind Netanyahu personally. They are behind the government's actions to defeat Hamas. So even, the Biden-Netanyahu years-long relationship, it has its limits when Netanyahu is so boxed in.
We're talking with Alex Ward, White House reporter covering national security for Politico, author of The Internationalist, The Fight to Restore American Foreign Policy After Trump, with Yasmin Abutaleb, White House reporter for The Washington Post, and Erica Green, White House correspondent for The New York Times. And we're talking with you, our listeners, 866-733-6786, the number, email address forum at kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum. IL writes, instead of starting on October 7th, how can a historical perspective inform the decisions the Biden administration should take with Israel moving forward? Patty writes, I don't think that President Biden really understood that he was not talking with the government of Yitzhak Rabin, who pushed hard for a two-state solution following the Oslo Accords and was assassinated for his efforts by an Israeli extremist. Prime Minister Netanyahu is in a position very similar to the one held by Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House. Former House Speaker McCarthy was held hostage by a group of hardline right-wing extremists, and he was forced to carry out their every wish in order to maintain his power and position. Peace will never come about under the Netanyahu government. The more the U.S. continues to support and elevate Netanyahu, the more unsafe Americans will be in the world, and the more our allies will turn away from us because we are on the wrong side of this conflict. Thank you, listeners, for sharing your perspectives there. Yasmin, I am wondering, how are Republicans here responding, if at all, to Biden's shift or reported shift in rhetoric and policy? Are they capitalizing on it in any way?
They a number of them definitely are. Republicans have taken this moment where not just Biden, but people like Chuck Schumer and other prominent Democrats are becoming much more critical of Israel and calling for conditioning aid, to say they are, really the true partners of Israel, and Democrats and the president are wavering and caving to demands from the more progressive wing of their party. So the president has put himself in this place where he sort of angered people on all sides. The people voting uncommitted or who have been very critical of his unconditional support of Israel for the last 6 months do not feel he's done nearly enough with the ramped up rhetoric or even the threat to potentially condition aid or issue sanctions or whatever he indicated to Netanyahu he would do if Israel did not meet his demands. And then for the staunchly pro-Israel crowd, it's a little bit mixed. There are some people who say, look, the president has sent Israel all this support. He has put his money where his mouth is. He's backed it up. Netanyahu's putting him in a tough position. There are a number of people who recognize that dynamic. But you've seen Republicans say, we're the true allies and partners of Israel. Democrats are wavering and caving to the left wing of their base. And so they have used that to try to use that to their political advantage. But that, of course, is complicated by the kind of muddled response we've gotten from Trump, where it's not really clear where he stands on this.
Naomi writes, my frustration with the Biden administration and the state of Israel is that neither party is truly committed to a full, peaceful and equitable solution for all parties involved. Biden continues to, quote, threaten consequences for Israeli aggression, but those are empty words designed to give the appearance of appeasing his constituents while doing absolutely nothing to back up his words. As a voter, I do not support my tax dollars going to support war of any kind, stipulations or not. Let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. I mean, Alex, if there was a conditioning of aid on humanitarian grounds or other reasons, do you just want to help us realize how big a departure that would be from a policy toward Israel over the last 50 years?
Sorry, if a ceasefire happens?
No, not a ceasefire. I'm sorry. Conditioning military aid for humanitarian reasons or otherwise, right? Just what a departure that would be from 50 years of Israel policy, really, when it comes to the U.S.
Oh, I apologize. I misunderstood. Well, we've seen it happen before in sort of subtle ways. And there have been discussions about, okay, we're going to condition aid. If you keep expanding the West Bank, et cetera, some have been followed through on, some not. But especially in this context, where there's been such bipartisan support for Israel, where it has been a third rail of American politics to do anything to be seen as on the wrong side of being Israel's staunch supporter, it would be a massive deal. It would be a historic break. And the fact that it would be Biden to do it, who has been one of the staunchest Israel supporters really for over his 50-year career, it would just be a remarkable moment, which is why I think, even we've had this discussion about, has the administration actually changed, really? I mean, the fact that it was Biden to even threaten anything, that's what makes it a news story, is that the avatar of America's staunch support for Israel, who has backed it more so than most politicians, Republican or Democrat, is what shows that something is changing in this relationship. And it's changing mostly, we should note, because of Democratic and progressive pressure. But all this to say is that, that bipartisan support that Israel could always rely on, if it was 100%, it might be at 93 now. But that 7% is remarkable. And then again, that it happened on Biden's watch at all is what makes it newsy.
This listener writes, this is not a war. This is a genocide. The U.S. has everything to stop this. Erica, you wrote an interesting piece about the influence of First Lady Jill Biden. What did you find?
So what we learned was during the president's meeting with Muslim leaders at the Ramadan, I would call it meeting, because it was not a dinner. Part of what he shared with participants was that, he was also hearing from people very, very close to him that they wanted this war to stop. He used it as, to punctuate the idea that he wanted it to end as soon as possible. And among those he has heard it from is his first lady. He shared with them that it was weighing on him greatly that his own wife had come to him and said, stop it now, Joe, like this has to end. And so we learned that from an attendee. We confirmed it, obviously, with the White House. And, she's just among several folks in the administration who he is personally close to, who have expressed despair about the course of the war, the human toll, the civilian casualties. She's among administration officials who are being protested and heckled when they go out on the campaign trail. But more importantly, she's a hugely influential person, and not only in his life but in his political career, and has intervened and not been shy about expressing, how she feels about certain inflection points in his career, as my colleague Katie Rogers has written a book about, if you want to read it. you will understand the magnitude of what how much weight her word carries. So that's what we learned. And And so she's, you know, that was new, and that we knew that there, obviously, within the administration, within the White House, there was a lot of dissent, a lot of debate. But Joe Biden's, you know, word obviously carries a lot of weight in a different way.
So, Yasmeen, let me put to you the question we've been putting to our listeners. If you think, in fact, that Joe Biden is ready to shift policy, condition aid, and so on, should he not see the progress that he's looking for with regard to the war? Where do you see that going?
I'm a bit skeptical that he's going to be willing to actually change U.S. policy, because we've seen this ramped up rhetoric for a couple months now. And I think this was alluded to earlier, but you can almost trace the sharp change in rhetoric. It had sort of been happening steadily for a couple months, but the sharp change to when a number of high level White House officials went to Michigan in early February to meet with members of the Muslim and Arab community to understand their concerns after they had rejected a meeting with Biden's campaign manager. I think Alex noted this earlier in the conversation. Israel did take a number of steps pretty immediately in response to the president's threat, opening an additional port, an additional crossing. I think the big question is whether more aid is actually getting into Gaza and getting distributed, because that has been the biggest challenge. Yes. But I think the president is going to be highly reluctant to actually condition or fundamentally change U.S. policy in any way.
Well, the listener writes, blaming all Democrats is throwing a too wide net. Most people we know, including my Jewish community, are in favor of de-escalation, a ceasefire, and replacement of the extremist Israeli government wreaking all this suffering and destruction. I want to thank you, Yasmeen Abutaleb of The Washington Post, for coming on today. Alex Ward as well, White House reporter covering national security for Politico. And Erica Green, White House correspondent for The New York Times. And thank you, listeners, for sharing your thoughts, your feelings, and your experiences around this at the six-month mark of the Israel-Hamas war. My thanks to Susie Britton for producing today's segment. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.